Thank you to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. We spend a lot of time talking about how important it is to take care of your mental health. Therapy is an excellent way to do that. BetterHelp is an affordable mental health care option that fits right into your busy schedule. Just answer a few quick questions about your needs and preferences, and BetterHelp will match you with one of the thousands of experienced mental health professionals in their network. You can talk to your therapist over text, chat, phone, or video. You get to pick what works best for you, your comfort, and your schedule. If you feel like your therapist isn't the right fit, BetterHelp makes it easy to switch to someone new at no additional cost. So give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. BetterHelp is offering our listeners 10% off their first month of therapy. Just go to betterhelp.com/musicspeaks to get started. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/musicspeaks to get 10% off your first month of therapy.
Like so many of you, we battle depression during life's many ups and downs.
Music has always been there to help us through the tough times that we all face.
Follow us on our journey as we discuss the healing power of music.
Interview artists and bands.
Break down genres and music news.
Review artist biographies.
And much, much more.
You're listening to the When Words Fail Music Speaks Podcast.
Hi, and welcome back to the When Words Fail Music Speaks Podcast. I'm Amanda Dolan, and I'm here with host James Cox, along with our amazing guest, Fred Mullen. We were just talking, he has had a decades-long career in the music industry, from producer to performer to composer. So we are so excited that you are here today. I'm just over the moon because I was telling James last night, we have a very loose, weird connection. So you wrote a song that Eddie Money produced, or Eddie Money performed.
That's right.
And about almost exactly 9 years ago now, holy mackerel, this podcast is about mental health, and I came very close to dying by my own hand. My therapist that saved my life is Eddie Money's sister.
Wow.
How weird is that?
I love that.
So that's our weird connection that actually isn't really a connection, but.
Yeah. Well, you did say it, but it was a very, very loose
connection. I just remember I looked at that last night and I was like, oh, she saved my life.
Well, you know, there's always that, what is it, that 9 degrees of separation or something? Or
yeah, there's always, we're always connected.
6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, they used to call it.
Yes. Yeah. I'm terrible at that game because I know all the things, but I can't remember the names of anyone or anything.
It's pretty wild.
It really is. And you are connected to all the people.
Yeah.
I mean, I was.
I wish that was the case. I feel definitely connected to a lot, for sure.
And some pretty amazing people. And by that, I just mean like not talent, not just well-known names, because like there are names that people know, but I think the talent can be behind the scenes oftentimes as much or more than in front of the microphone on stage.
Yeah.
And a lot of your, well, I'm curious about how you got your start with tin cans in your backyard, right?
Yeah.
Did I put that in the book? Because that doesn't sound right to me.
Is that not accurate? Okay.
It is accurate. I'm trying to remember how you know that.
It's secrets.
I mean, we have secrets. Our ways.
Yeah, okay. We got our ways.
Yes, there. I did. I started out in the old days. There were tin cans in the backyard for garbage. And I remember setting up a drum set when I was about 5. And I would do my tin can drum set. That's right. Yeah. So I think I always had if you feel like you have a gift or a calling. I certainly did have something in the blood that made me want to be a musician. Although at 5, I didn't know what I wanted to do, really. And it really wasn't until the Beatles hit in 64 and I was 11 that I really felt like a lightning bolt struck me. And it struck so many of my peers. It was sort of like, we just know exactly now what we're going to do. And immediately I just grabbed a guitar. My sister had a folk guitar, started playing guitar. Then, of course, you know, when I was 13, I got bar mitzvahed, and instead of a big bar mitzvah, I asked my parents for an electric guitar like George Harrison had and a Fender amp. And I, you know, at that point, though, really from 11 on, I really knew what I wanted to do, which was to make music. Now, of course, then I wanted to have long hair, a really cool guitar, and I wanted the girls to scream over me. You know, that's what I wanted. But then I realized, of course, that it really was about the music. And by the time I was, you know, 13 years old, I was writing songs and putting little bands together. And but the Beatles changed everything. I don't know what I would have done. I might have gone into art actually, and because I had some talent for drawing and possibly painting, whatever. But music just took me over.
I'm very excited that you mentioned the Beatles because every time I go into a store and I see a Beatles album, I have to get it. I just have
There
to
you
get
go.
it,
Yeah.
because
Well,
my
you're,
because
but you, I mean,
my
you're very young, so you know, you have to understand that you
oh
weren't
no
there at the time when, because it really was like the world changed, you know.
yeah right yeah yeah yes sir yes sir yeah And I thank you for that young comment because I'm 45, so I mean, you know. But I'm getting, you know.
You're a puppy, as they
All
say.
right.
You really are.
Well,
You know, it's funny. My mother talked about the Beatles and how she was not allowed to listen to them. She grew up in a very, you know, Southern conservative, you know, Christian, right? And she couldn't listen to rock and roll. And so, once I got the chance to, I like in growing up, music was, it was my way of, dare I say, rebelling in some ways, listening to what I wanted to and not what my parents did. But were your parents musicians too, or was that just something that was from your soul?
Well, certainly the irony is, my parents, never in my lifetime did I ever hear my parents listen to music. Ever.
Yeah, you learned that from your
Really?
sister, right?
It was my
Because,
sister and brother who were older than me, 7 years and 11 years older. And so I would hear them play the radio, et cetera, and my sister would buy, you know, Broadway show music or whatever. But my parents never listened to music. My father apparently, in the earlier part of his life, when he would pass by a piano, could just effortlessly pick out the melody of the day. But that's all we ever know about what happened to me. I probably was adopted. I don't know it, you know.
Oh no.
But that ability to just pick up a melody is
Yeah.
spectacular. It's
Well,
something
that
that.
apparently was, my father did that. I never saw him do it in my lifetime, but apparently when he was younger.
So you talked about getting started with rhythm, and I know you play drums as well. I think of rhythm as the backbone of music, as is producing. So I'm curious, like how rhythm got you into music, and then how music, like how you got to producing, I guess, because you went from like the backbone starting to the most important part of at least recording and sharing music, which is the
Well,
producing part.
first of all, you're very kind to say that. You know, pr record producers are really, I don't know when the term got used, probably sometime in the late 50s, that someone became a record producer. But we're really directors. I mean, you know, we are analogous to a film director, in the sense that we take care of everything, and we're also there to oversee the artistic developments in the movie, which is the record. And so, you know, I think it's important to understand that, you know, the artist is obviously the most important part of a record, but the production and the person he works with, the producer, can be as important as a director. So I've never understood the word producer for records, because most people, when they hear that and they don't know what that means, they'll say, "Oh, do you put the money up for the record?" And I say, "No, I'm the director of the record, you know." So to answer your question, I think your question really was, how did I become a record producer? Is that so?
Right. How did you get there?
You know, I wish I could find a snappy, funny answer and just get it out of the way. But it's a little bit longer than that, but I'll try to truncate it. I was in Toronto at that point. I had quit school at 16 to pursue my musical goals, which at that point were, I was trying to get a record deal for myself as a singer-songwriter. And I just didn't have the luck. And I don't think I was that good. I mean, I think I could have been but I was never going to be as good as a James Taylor or someone who I aspired to be. And I wound up, my brother had moved to Toronto when I was 17, and I was already out of school in New York. And he said, "You should come to Canada and come to Toronto." He said, "It might give you a good opportunity that you don't have in New York." So I went to visit, and basically I never left, because the minute I got there, I had gigs and a college, a bunch of college gigs and a girlfriend. And I was like, I told my parents, "Just send my stuff up, I'm not coming home, And so a lot of levels, Toronto and Canada were like a paradise for me. And so within the next few years, so by the time, let's say I was 19, I had started to play a lot of clubs, singer-songwriter gigs all over Toronto. And one of the guys I was actually sort of not competing with, but he was a fellow singer-songwriter, we played the same clubs, was Dan Hill, who was a wonderfully talented guy, a year younger than me. And, we just fell into a great friendship. And out of nowhere, I think I was about 19, he said, "Hey, would you help me produce a demo? I'm doing a demo of my new songs because I'm trying to get a new record deal." And I was like, I knew what a production, a record producer did. I wasn't in any way sort of like, "Hey, what's that?" No, I had been almost a musicologist. I was absolutely raised on listening to records and knowing who did what and who played on what, who produced it. And, so I was sort of honored that Dan said, "Would you help me produce this demo?" Now, in those days, it was a small little studio, and it was a four-track reel-to-reel studio. But nevertheless, it was, I took it very seriously. I went down there, and I guess the story needs relating. So I went to the studio. It was a basement studio called Captain Audio in Toronto. And here I am. I'm going to produce an acoustic guitar and vocal demo. I mean, by the way, not much producing needed really on acoustic guitar and vocal demo. But there I am, Mr. 19-year-old producer. And when I get there's a guy, and this is probably 1974, I guess. Yeah, 70, or maybe 73. There's a guy who's sitting on the couch in the studio, and he's got a peasant shirt, and he's got a big black long beard. But he's my age, long dark hair and big beard and mustache. And I was introduced, and I said, "That's great." And we started the recording, and I noticed this guy was sort of taking over and becoming the producer. And I'm thinking to myself, "Wait a second, I'm the producer." And so for the first hour or so, it was like two roosters that were in a pen, it wasn't good. But then within about an hour and a half, I guess we both got rid of the tension and both realized we liked each other. And then by the end of the 4 hours or whatever, we both realized we had really good ideas. And then we went for a dinner that night, and we really became fast friends. And it turned out that it was a Machiavellian creative blind date that Danny had done. This was a guy he had grown up with in Toronto. His father, Matthew's father, was one of Toronto's premier musical directors and symphony directors. So Matt had a lot of skill, especially in that world. And Danny felt like the two of us could make a great team. So he put this blind date together without us knowing it. And it worked like a charm. And to this day, Matt is still my closest friend. And we produced records together till he didn't want to do that anymore early on in his life, because he married someone very wealthy. And then I produced on my own for the rest of my life. But Matthew to this day still does my string charts and comes and conducts and stuff. But basically, from that point on, I liked the fact. Now, I wasn't giving up my solo career yet, but I was starting to edge away from it because I started to like making records, and we started to make records. We started to get the first album was an album called Dan Hill that Matthew's parents financed. And so it became a hit in Canada. And the next thing you know, I am a record producer. And so I did, I did fall into something behind the camera, and I really liked it. Sorry, it's
So
a
you
long
said,
answer.
oh no, but I, but
Perfect.
you know that you kind of noted that you started in this basement studio, just an acoustic guitar and a voice, not much producing. Producing has changed pretty significantly over the last, I'm going to say 50 years. And that,
God,
that's, yeah. But also like the 70s is 30 years ago. You can't convince me otherwise. Right. Like, cause 1990 was 10 years ago. Yeah. I don't care. It was, but you know, in the last 50 years, producing has changed. And I think that we've gone from, you know, like you said, just the reels to digital. And now there's computers that can do everything, virtually all the work for you.
Yeah. I mean, we're really even now hitting a whole nother new level with AI, where we're going to have to see what that can do to help us or to hurt us. I don't know.
Right. But does the technology now, do you, in your professional opinion, do you find that better or a little bit kind of not like what it used to be, you know, back in like 10 years ago, like Amanda said?
Yeah. You know, 10 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. You know, just a little bit. Right.
It's a interesting question, and one I've been asked before. Again, I can expand on it a little bit. What I love about making records is the performance aspect. This is me. The performance aspect of making music in the studio is joyful for me. And but then the technology now has afforded me a number of things which are fantastic. The first thing, of course, is with digital recording, you know, it's just to the point now where, you know, you just can't go wrong. You know, if you're doing anything and you don't, you know, and you screw up, it's easy to fix. You know, in the old days, you could fix it by punching in on the tape and redoing something. Or you know, when I was starting, technology was already happening to do that. You know, 10 years before that, you couldn't do that. But now, I mean, listen, if there's any problems at all, you know, if I cut the song in the wrong key, you know, literally it's the push of a button to turn all the instruments into the right key. And if I sang the vocal on that song, it would change my vocal to the right pitch, but not change the sound of my voice. That's crazy. I mean, we're looking at what we consider that to be monumental, but now with AI, there'll be even goofier stuff. But the question is, I think, I never want to lose the performance aspect of what I do. I use live musicians most of the time. I rarely use programming. I really mostly use live musicians, and you know, and we use the technology to do things like, you know, to help. For instance, here's a great example of what technology is so beautiful for me. When I started, which was again 73 or something, there weren't even computerized consoles, and certainly no digital recording, and so everything was recorded on tape. And when you would mix everything you did at the end, and I'm not an engineer, so my engineer would mix. Mm-hmm. When you'd mixed in the analog days of the 70s, you know, you could have done a beautiful record. And then when you get to the mix, it's possible that a bad mix would ruin everything you did. And it was a terrible feeling as someone who couldn't engineer, knowing that, boy, you know, this is a lot of pressure, because if my engineer doesn't do a great mix, we've got to go try to find another day and mix it again. It costs more money, blah, blah, blah. And all my efforts and, you know, or Matt's and my efforts in the early days could have been sort of screwed if a bad mix happened. And, you know, and a bad mix could be anything from the vocal wasn't loud enough to there's too much snare drum, or, you know, just an overall that it didn't gel the way we had wanted it to gel all through the recording of the record. So to be honest, I used to have great anxiety and great stomach aches before mixing. And in those days too, by the way, you know, when we would mix, Matt and I, my partner at that point, and our engineer, we'd all be on the console on different faders, doing things in the mix, because there was no automation. So there was a lot of pressure to make sure the mix even bettered what we had done up to that point. The minute Pro Tools came in, my stomach got great.
Right, okay.
And my anxiety disappeared. Because all of a sudden, if I didn't like a mix, I just tell my engineer and say, oh yeah, I can change that, you know, again, a couple of swipes, a couple of
And
buttons
you push
pushed.
that button right there, and it'll, yeah,
Yeah.
right,
And
yeah.
then, how do you like that? I go, that's great. Thanks. The old days, it was like the guys would take the faders, slam them down, and say, come back in 6 hours. I'll try again.
Was
So instead of a day, it's minutes.
Seconds sometimes. Yeah.
Fascinating.
So
Pro Tools.
for that alone, I adore the technology that allows me to do that kind of mixing, where I can send the project to my engineer. He mixes at home. He sends me a mix. He sends the artist a mix. We listen to it at home on our good listening systems. We make our notes. A half an hour later, he's implemented our notes. We get a perfect mix. Next song. It's that great. And of course, had you told me that in 1973, I would have said, oh, that would be great. But it wasn't to be for quite a while.
There's a lot of studio recordings of DAWs with the Digital Audio Workshop or workstation, and Pro Tools is, yes, Pro Tools is the industry standard,
It is, yeah.
but have you ever went out and experimented with other DAWs and like Fruit Loops and like there's Fruit Loops, Reaper, and like a whole lot of other things. Did you experiment with other things to get that sound that you needed, or did Pro Tools like
No, I mean,
it's okay?
by the time I started using Pro Tools, I was in Nashville when I moved here in 2001. And it was just that it was everyone in town used it. It became the industry standard. And I'm not an engineer. So I just said, okay, great. I mean, the only kind of stuff that we do dabble with differently, there's two industry standard vocal tuning situations. One is called, I'm spacing out. Wait a second.
Logic.
Oh, sorry. One is Melodyne and one is actually called Auto-Tune. Auto-Tune, people either love or hate. And again, it can go automatically or you can actually graph tune, literally perfectly. And that's what we do. And Melodyne is also a great format. And you can also graph tune with Melodyne. And so some people love Melodyne more, some people like Antares Auto-Tune more. Again, whatever engineer is doing my vocal comping and putting things together on the vocals, what's whatever format they like, but it's all on Pro Tools.
So we all know that music or songs take a long time to develop and construct, right? Has there ever been a time where you spent like hours and hours working on something and it just didn't sound right to you, and then you went out to lunch or like walking in the park or something, and it automatically hit you that you like that sound that you just heard, because music gets everywhere,
Now you're talking about me as a producer. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Very rarely, Jay. I'm really, I'm a good problem solver on the floor or in the studio, in the control room or on the floor with the musicians, because I'm an arranger and a musician as well. So, no, I mean, and again, if I have an idea, it might come later to me, but it's an overdub and I fix it then.
Cool.
I think that comes in with like the, you said you're a director as much as a producer. You have, when I think of directors too, like in a movie situation, right? You've got to deal with all the different actors and their egos and their creativity and your vision, and you have done a heck of a lot of duets with some really spectacular artists, like, right? I mean, everyone from Crosby
Wow,
and Nash
love
and
it.
Art Garfunkel and who were some of the other ones I saw,
Wow, love it, Joe Cocker.
and Brian Wilson. So how do you balance your creativity and each of the artists' creativity? And I'm not talking about like egos and any of that, but just we all have different, artistic styles. So how do you get all of those to be balanced and create
How do you
beautiful?
keep all that in order?
Yeah, I mean, again, these are great questions. Thank you. I'm going to be really honest. For some reason, I'm incredibly selfless in my work as an artist's producer. I work when I work to make them, I work to give them joy and to fulfill their vision of what they want their record to be. So my ego is so not anywhere near there. And then also when I get to work with other musicians, sorry, other artists, you know, in these duet situations, and I've had so many great opportunities. You know, it's just about being kind and knowing how to work with people, which is, you know, it just comes with the territory. I've done this for so long that it's just common sense to me of how to work with any kind of unique artist and to try to make them comfortable, and it's second nature. I wish I was as selfless in the rest of my life, but my kids will tell you I wasn't. I mean, I think my daughter, you know, at one point, one of my artists was over for dinner when my daughter was 7, and she just thought so highly of me. She kept on saying, "Oh my God, Fred's so selfless," and you know, "My God, I've never been produced by anyone like this before," and you know, she kept on using the word selfless and just kept on going. And my daughter finally looked at her and said, "Who the F are you talking about?"
All right.
At 7. And she couldn't understand who she was talking about, because daddy probably wasn't that selfless. You know, I think for some reason, br it brings out the best in me to produce other people.
It sounds like you want to lift them up, highlight their unique qualities
Yeah,
and
I want them to look good. I want them, and they make me look good. You know, if I do a good production, of course, you know, then, you know, people think I do a good job. But no, it's really just about the fact that it's out of respect to the people I'm working with, and the love of what I do.
I love that. And I have, I know how hard it is to have teenagers and to what's the best word for it? Play the negotiator, the mediator, with lots of emotions and hormones and things. It's a lot. And so yeah, sometimes I just can't imagine the patience that comes with
I wish I was as patient in my real life. I'm really not. I'm a very impatient person. But when I make records and I'm working with others, I am extremely patient, and it's my best self, really.
So your creativity is where your greatness, or in part, I mean, there's lots and lots of great things about you with.
I think I suck at most things. I think I'm pretty good at producing, so.
And
You're
you
amazing
talked
at
about,
producing.
arranging too. And I realized when I was doing some research that you actually arranged a number of the songs that I listened to in my car with my children when they were young.
Yes.
Okay.
Lots and lots of Disney songs, lullabies, all of that. So Disney, like, let's face it, Disney music and lullabies is very different than,
Your
like you said, the
standard.
Beatles.
Yes.
And yet I might argue that for me during those years, that might have been some of the most, like, that Disney music, quiet, peaceful, calm music was more important than any music that I listened to on my own. So what got you from rock and roll and to Disney?
Well, actually, it's even goofier than that, because you know, by 1998, when I got the phone call from Walt Disney Records, I had already done, you know, the music for Friday the 13th, Part 7, Friday the 13th, Part 8, and 72 1-hour episodes of Friday the 13th, the series. And I had done other, you know, horror stuff and sci-fi stuff. And then I get a phone call from Jay Landers in 1998, who said, you know, "I've got this idea to do an album called Disney's Lullaby Album, and I would love you to do it. Just rearrange songs of Disney and other songs into instrumental lullaby versions." And you know, he said, "What do you think?" I said, "Well, probably piano and strings or guitar and strings." And he said, "But make it really meditative." And it really turned into quite a long run. And frankly, it is probably still one of the most I'm most proud of those projects. because it does such good. But also, it makes a lot of money. So I'm delighted to say that it really paid off. But
Hey.
I think it was very ironic that the horror film score guy was getting the call to do the lullabies, you know. Anyway, so the first lullaby album, I mean, it was very interesting to make because it went against a lot of the things you do when you make records. When you make records, you know, if I produce a record, I want people to really pay attention and listen to it, you know, and I want to knock them out, whether it's emotional, whether it's exciting, whatever. When you make a Disney or instrumental lullaby album of any label, although Disney is the best ones for those, you go the opposite way, which is you do not want to wake the baby. So everything has to be completely calm and almost hypnotic and meditative. And even the strings, even though we had a big string orchestra, they could never go da 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 da. It could has to go. So it was really a tremendous lesson in restraint. And I think I got it right the first time because that's my most successful album that I've ever been the artist on. I think it really does serve a great purpose. I mean, people in my life who have had children who have listened to that record with the kids and or put them to sleep with it have profusely thanked me. And I know I did a good job on those things, but you know, listen, I just bought a new car a couple months ago, and you know, when the girl saw my name, she said, "You're not the guy who did the Disney lullaby albums, are you?" And I said, "Yeah." She started to cry. And she said, "You know, that put me to sleep every year for till I was 7 or 8 years old." And I said, "Can I get a little better deal now?" In other words, no. No, but she was so lovely, and she was, but she was at first, it was funny because at first she was sort of all business, and then when she realized who I was to her, she's became my best friend. But it's
Nice.
amazing though, you know, my career has had so many odd turns. I would never have expected me to be Disney's most successful instrumental lullaby artist.
And here you are.
Yeah.
And I,
Yeah.
because when I was looking, I was like, I remember these from my kids being little, especially in the car, like my,
Yeah, but if you were driving, you might fall asleep while you're driving.
Right. We don't
Yeah.
want
No, my
to
brain goes too fast.
do
But you
it
know, that's I have ADHD and sometimes I struggle with focus. And so I know that like bilateral, music and those sorts of that meditative music can actually not just, it doesn't make me fall asleep, but it does quiet
Yeah.
the world around me. And so I appreciate
Well,
that
I think
instrumental version of
there was
things.
certainly the intention on all the different ones we've done. I mean, I've done five, I guess, to be able to have the parents or caretakers love the music as well.
Because that was music from my childhood as well. I was 9 or 10, like when The Little Mermaid came out. So, that was the music that the Disney music I grew up on. Those were the,
Part of this world, yeah.
yeah. So, a lot of those songs were ones that I was familiar with, but also, I think there was a Cars in there, maybe.
I've
Nope.
done two albums that are associated with the movie Cars,
Maybe
and they're
that's what.
songs about cars for young children.
Yeah, there's Lightning McQueen's Fast Tracks.
And actually, they're really fun records. I mean, they're fun records for adults, but they're also great for kids.
For kids.
Which, as a parent, I appreciate kids' music that is also enjoyable for me.
We never want to make a kid's record that is going to be so annoying that the parents are not going to play it, you know.
Well, see, that's what I want to ask you about, because you did It's Great to Be a Kid in 2021 and Special Days 2023. And I listened to It's Great to Be a Kid, and that brought back memories of me learning, how to do stuff, So lullabies is instrumental. These two albums have lyrics in them, right? So when you were starting to write lyrics for children, did you tap back into your childhood and say, okay, well, this is the way how I wanted to listen to a song, or Did you like how do you write for like a child with lyrics?
Sure.
Is this
Well,
really the question?
I started doing Disney records that had lyrics and writing songs for those things with one called Finding Nemo Ocean Favorites. Because Finding Nemo was a phenomenon. They wanted an album of songs that were basically fish songs. So either I had to write them or we found songs that were about the deep blue sea. But when I started to write, and then I did a lot of other albums for Disney where I wrote a lot of the songs, it really wasn't that I was tapping into my childhood. It really was a craft. It was like, I think a kid would like a song about playtime, or I think a kid would like a song about, whatever. And so, it's really more of a craft than anything else. I'm not really tapping into anything, but it's a craft that I felt really. It really was easy for me. I found a lot of satisfaction, and I found it to be very easy.
I'm always fascinated when people say, "Oh, I found writing music to be easy." Meanwhile, like, I can't.
Well, but let me interrupt, because writing music for kids I find easy. If you said to me, Fred, you got to write 10 new songs for an album, I'd be in a corner crying. Because
I would too.
I couldn't do that. I mean, I would need a co-writer. I couldn't do it on my own. But for kids' music, I can just do it effortlessly. I don't know why. I think the criteria is different. I just think it's easier. And if we're trying to write great songs, I've worked with the great songwriters all my life, and I think their shadows really get in the way of me trying to write songs now.
Oh, that's an interesting way to think of it because.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to write a song for adults when you've produced the greatest songwriters in the world all your life, and you're the bar is so high that what I'm writing never hits that bar. I'm going, this is not good.
So I'm curious. I'm sorry. The
No.
this is kind of set, but is it that the bar, like the bar is so high that you don't think that you can reach it, or is it like truly that the bar is that high? And by that I mean, like, do you second guess yourself more
Oh,
because of that
yes.
level?
Yeah, I just don't have the confidence, because I know what great songs are, and I know how hard it is to write a great song, and that was never my particular best skill or best part of my creativity. I was really great at producing songwriters and making their songs great and making them great. But when it came down to me writing my own songs, especially songs that might be sort of autobiographical a little bit, I just didn't have that same torture inside of me that a lot of the great songwriters do. And I think also I just would be writing a song and I'd say, gee, is this as good as Jimmy Webb could have written? Is this as good as, whoever, and I'd be like, no. And then I would say, well, why am I bothering? And really, the only reason I'd bother is if I was hired. If a TV film or a movie wanted me to write a song for the movie, to end the film or something, I could write that because they gave me a subject, and that's a craft. But when looking at a blank page, in the same way that a James Taylor or a Paul Simon or, Jimmy Webb would look at a blank page and write incredible songs, I was never really able to write at that level. And probably, like you said, Amanda, I probably also was my own worst enemy because I didn't have that belief that I could do that.
I think there's that interesting point too that you made when given some direction, it's a whole lot easier to do things. I think that's true for so many of us in so many ways. We get a little bit lost and overwhelmed when there's
Yes.
everything.
Yeah.
And when you've got even just the tiniest bit of this is the direction to go in,
It's very
it's
helpful. I mean, when you get a lot of direction, like we want a song about this part of the movie, you can do it a lot easier. I can anyway.
Does, I'm curious, how does that affect your creativity if you're given so much, like such a narrow scope of what to write about?
It depends on how narrow they give. I mean, sometimes they'll give you a song and say, we want something like that, in which case, by the way, you don't do it. You say no, because you don't want to be ever having someone come after you saying, the classic example is Ghostbusters, right? Which was Ray Parker, who was a great musician in LA. I love Ray. Ray was hired to do the song for Ghostbusters, but they had used what they call a temp track in the editing of the movie. And a temp track means temporary track, which means they're not going to use it, but they use it for the editing. And then they sort of get married to it. The producers and director get married to it. And then when the composer comes in, they say, hey, we want something like this.
Oh, yeah.
And so they had temp tracked Huey Lewis, I Want a New Drug. Bum, 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 bum. I want a new drug. Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah,
Ghostbusters. Dun, dun,
it's the
dun,
same,
dun.
right?
It's the same song. And Ray got sued, and Ray lost all his royalties, and Huey Lewis got all the royalties. And that's okay because, it was a complete, I mean, it was understood that they had him dead to rights. They had told him to write a song like this. He wrote it too damn close. Yeah.
Yeah, I've always wondered, like, what is the cutoff to make a song like just like something else, you know? Could it be like a different well, obviously it's a melody, but I mean you have like 24 you have six strings on a guitar, 24 frets. I mean you I there's endless amounts in some ways, and sometimes you find that exactly a song that, you know, that's kind of odd but kind of cool and weird at the same time, you know?
No, I think, there's a lot of people who have to try to get the same spirit that they've used in a temp track on the song you're writing. But no, you can't go near the actual progressions of the chords or the main licks. And really, unfortunately, Ray Parker did.
Mean, Ed Sheeran recently won a copyright
He did. Yes. Yeah.
lawsuit where, you know, he
I
said,
wasn't
hey,
paying
there's
attention
only
to that. You know,
you what? I'm
I
sorry.
hadn't paid attention to this one.
Oh, so essentially it was, you know, he went up and he said, like, look, here's the, you know, there's only this many chords and this many
I
ways to put
think,
them together. So of course there's going to be overlap.
yeah, I think one song sounded just like a Marvin Gaye song, right, Amanda? So,
Yes, it was. Was it Let's Get It On?
I don't know.
I think
I
so.
want to say yes.
But I believe that the jury came back pretty quickly that, you know, it was not a,
Not a
like, there
rip-off,
wasn't a copyright infringement. And I think, you know, there's only like, there's only so many, like you said, there's only so many chords and
Progression.
notes that can go together.
But
And,
you still have to be careful.
well,
oh, absolutely. I
That's
mean, I
true.
think, I don't know. There's so much creativity, though. I think I can't. I've tried to play the guitar. I have a guitar back here
She has one. I
that
need to
I
learn to
have.
play mine.
It's not my strong suit. I love to sing. I am not. I would need a whole lot of auto tune to sound good. And just like, yeah,
We
my
got you
kids.
covered, Emma. Okay.
There you go.
Yeah,
Yes,
my.
wait.
I'm sure, I know I annoy my poor children in the car because I will sing a lot, and
She
my favorite thing
sings
to do
loudly and
is
proudly,
yes and poorly.
and
My
poorly.
favorite thing to do though is as soon as the song starts, I know the lyrics. I never know the name of the song or the
Artist,
artist or the album, but I sure know the lyrics, and I will. A song will start, and I'll look at my kids, and I will say the first line or two of the song, and then it'll start, and they're like, "Ugh."
Oh, God, Mom.
What? It's
Yeah.
so, they've proven that it's so therapeutic to your mental health to sing in the
Is.
car.
Yeah,
Oh, it's like my
absolutely.
favorite thing.
Like,
And
I
I
mean, literally, they
know.
have proven this. It's absolutely, it opens up endorphins, and it's good for you to sing in the car.
And you can pick, especially now with iTunes or, you know, Apple Music and Spotify, all of that. It's easy to pick exactly what mood you're in, pick the song that you
Love
or
it.
whatever. And I love to sing in the car, and I love singing in the car with my kids. There's also something incredibly, It's the relationship that we build. Like
I
my
would have
son
been
will.
shyer. I would have been shy to sing in the car with my kids. I like singing in the car when I'm alone.
Or yes,
See,
or
my
in the
kids
shower,
and
you know.
my so I'm afraid to look at when this song came out, but Carly Rae Jepsen's "Call Me Maybe."
I love that song.
Yeah, oh, 2016, I think. Right,
26. Maybe. So my son he loves that song, or he loved it when he was little, and now he is 16. And the other day we were in the car driving, and he goes, "Oh, we should play our song." And in my head, I was thinking "Our Song" by Taylor Swift.
Yeah,
that was just where my brain went, because that's, you know, the title of the song. And so I go to put it on, and he goes, "No, Our Song." And he turns on that song.
Mm.
And I mean, we have a whole dance in the car. We, you know, like we sing to each other. It is a moment that we bond, and like that will forever be like just ours. That feels weird to say. I know that song belongs to the world, and yet when I hear that with my son next to me, especially in the car, it is just us in the world singing and dancing and being in that moment together.
That's a beautiful thing.
And so I love the idea of, I need to do more research and like, and look into the importance of music in the car.
Singing is extremely good for your soul. And it makes you happier if you sing.
Oh, I agree. And I love to dance party in my living room too. There's something about like,
you won't see me dancing much, but
no, no, me neither.
No, but I bet you dance. Just no one sees you dance.
No, I don't. I really don't. I do suck at that and don't do it. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think we all have our things that work out. I'm not good at dancing. I think I just don't care anymore.
If you ever see me dance, you need to call you need to call 911. Really,
there you go. So we do have a few more questions for you, and we do thank you very, very much for coming on the show.
Oh my god!
But I want to give. So you are coming out with a book called Unplugged.
Well, you know what's funny? You mentioned that because.
Hey,
oh, do you have it right there?
Here it is. Yes. That book that you see right there on YouTube, ladies and gentlemen, comes out on May 11th, 2025 this year. But I do have a question for you. So that Unplugged title was a second title that you came up with, because first, I can't remember the exact title, but you looked on Amazon and you saw six books called the same thing. And you're like,
yeah,
I can't do this, right?
You know, first of all, I really, as much as I, you know, am proud, incredibly proud that I wrote this book, of the accomplishment, you know, I know I'm a behind the scenes person. So the book really is about the people I've worked with and the projects I've done. And I was going to soft pedal it, 'cause that's just who I am. I was thinking maybe, you know, Fred Mullen, A Life in Music. I had a lot of titles, and one of them was Before I Forget.
That's it, yes.
I thought it was a really good title.
Yeah.
So I went and checked Amazon, and there were five other books.
Yeah,
Before I Forget.
Right.
So I had to scrap that. And then a dear friend, Penn Densham, who's a film director, a wonderful film director in Hollywood, who wrote his own memoir, said, you know, you're going to learn from my mistakes, he said to me. I want you to have a book title and a subtitle that immediately tells people what you do. You can't just say Fred Mullen, A Life in Music, because no one knows who you are. So it went against the grain for me, but he said, call the book Unplugged. I checked it out. There were a few books called Unplugged, but no music book. And he said, the subtitle has to be all the things you do, you know, and then on the back, it's got to have the people that you worked with and blah, blah, blah. So I had to basically bring my ego back into play a little bit. Which is hard for me. I felt very, I'm a self-deprecating kind of guy, so I don't really like the spotlight, you know, for too long. And I don't like to sort of be arrogant. And I felt initially I should soft pedal. And then Penn just said, listen, I did a book called Riding the Alligator, which was my life story and also a primer on how to write for TV and film. He said, and it did nothing. And he said, had I called it, you know, Adventures in Screenwriting with a subtitle of All the Things I've Done. So
Yeah.
I would have had people saying, I want to read that book.
Yeah.
But instead, I called it something sort of cool. I said, Riding the Alligator, you know, and he said it just flopped simply because of that, because no one knew who I was. And he said, I'm not letting you do the same mistake.
Well, that book covers 50 years of film composing and record producing and some of your stories that you've lived on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if the subtitle is Stories and Secrets from a Life of Making Records, Scoring Film, and Working with the Legends of Music, and I feel that's okay. That's
Yeah.
true, you
There
know.
you go. Yeah.
I mean,
Okay.
I don't want to ever be perceived as someone who's full of themselves. And I don't want to ever feel that I'm sort of expanding on the truth, which I would never want to do.
And I always ask people, is it arrogant if it's true?
Yeah, I mean, I want to make I want to be truthful and proud of what I've done, but I don't want it to come off as a that I'm full of myself, you know. So
Part of me is like, but you have the right to be, because I look at the credits and I'm sorry, I didn't remember the friend that said, people don't know who you are. And it's kind of, I think there's truth in that, that people don't recognize your name, and yet every person probably in the United States has heard something that you have done, something you've worked on, something that you've had your hands
Sure,
in.
sure. Yeah, well, that comes with being I've done this all my life, so sure, that does occur. But listen, I'm extremely proud of my accomplishments in my life, and the book certainly is a I wrote the book for two reasons. One is I had a lot of stories that I did not want to forget, and the other reason was I wanted to have something on paper that was a legacy for my kids and for their kids and whatever.
Nice. And you're going to be at the Field Music Festival on Sunday, June 29th to meet and greet and sign that book. Or did
Which
I?
one? Which festival? Sorry.
It's the Field Music Festival, right? It's the FIL Music Festival or something.
Film
Or
music. I mean, in the
in
top.
Martha Vineyards. Oh,
The Martha
yeah.
Vineyards.
Okay.
Yeah. The
Yeah.
Martha's Vineyards Film Center is having an event for me in July,
Right.
and I think it's in July. And then because I have a home, one of my homes in my for many years was Martha's Vineyard, and I'm still there for the summer, and so I have there's a big part of my life that's part of the vineyard, and so you know I've been very fortunate that the people there want to celebrate the book with different events, and
Yeah.
that's just one of them. But yeah, listen, I'm a cheap date. If anybody wants me to come sign a book somewhere, I'll get there.
There you go. And I'm going to
Hey.
order your book when it comes out, because I need to start reading, and I'm being collecting books, and your book just, I want to know everything about you and your.
I'm so honored. I can send you guys an ebook, and you can
Yeah.
read it
Oh
that way,
yeah.
or you can wait till the real deal, and I think May 11th is the day. So.
Well, whether you see me in ebook or not, I'm still buying a book, brother. Yeah,
Well, and
because I love hard copies. So yeah.
yeah, me
And
too. I have a big book collection.
I hope that you come out with an audiobook, because I struggle with reading, but I can listen to an audiobook all day long. There's something magical about sound for
You
me.
know, I have a wonderful partner, Karen Richmond, who's a well-known film actress, and we're together in L.A. and Nashville, and we were talking about it last night, and she said, "Well, you know, let me hear your voices for the audiobook." So I auditioned a few styles, you know, and I'll do one. I'll do one, but you know, it's a little daunting because you know. It's a lot of words to read, you
Yeah.
know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
Yeah.
I'm sure. And also, there are people like me that appreciate audiobooks. It
I'm going to
means that I
do.
get to read. And I know that there's people out there and be like, oh, audiobooks aren't real reading. Yes, it is. I
Of
because
course it
I'm
is.
getting the
It is,
information,
yeah.
and
No, I'm going to do one. I have to get myself organized to do it. Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to hear your voice
Yeah.
tell your story, because it's always a beautiful thing to me when I hear someone's story in their own words.
Yes, in
You
their
know
own
who
voice
wrote
too. Yeah.
an incredible memoir musician is Brandi Carlile, Breaking Horses. Is that the the name of it, I think. But she, during like the audiobook, she has songs that she wrote during those periods that she's talking about. And then at the end of the audiobook is a full album that, you know, is songs and talks about like that, all those parts of her life that she shared. So I think,
I mean, I think it's a wonderful thing to do. I'm a little, you know, I'll get the courage up tonight.
I will encourage you all day long. I'm here for that. So I'm excited to read your story and all of the amazing accomplishments that you have.
Thank you. And I guess a shameless plug is the book comes out May 11th. But if people want to go to my book website, which is fredmullinunplugged.com, you can order through that website and there'll be signed copies through the website.
Nice.
Spectacular. Well, so we'll link that in the show notes.
Yeah. Please.
And I'm definitely going to go there today, matter of fact, and been pre-ordered a book. That's a little out yet.
You can pre-order on Amazon and Barnes and Noble, etc. But
but then we don't get your signature.
I mean, if anybody wants my signature, again, I'm a cheap date.
Okay.
So right. I think we have two more questions for you before we let you go.
Of course.
All right. Okay. So James, go.
So we're gonna do a Mount Rushmore of artists that you love to work with, or favorite bands, or any one of your favorite music. Okay, we need four of them. What would be your four?
My four favorite artists I've worked
with. Your Mount Rushmore of music,
famous period.
The four that just have maybe impacted the music the most in the world.
Well, I think Lennon and McCartney would have to be one of them.
Yeah. Okay.
Can we make Lennon and McCartney one?
Yeah. Yes. Please do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Because obviously the Beatles changed everything. Buddy Holly for sure. Buddy Holly was my first real. As a little kid, I was inspired by him. I would say probably Jimmy Webb, who I've been working with all my life, which is amazing. And then maybe. Boy, this is tough. I have so many people I love.
I know.
Mount Rushmore. Boy, I have to think about this for a second. They're probably all songwriters mostly, you know. So I would say, James Taylor would be there.
Great pick. Yeah.
I need a Mount Rushmore of about 20 to 30.
35.
That's why this is such a hard question, because
say to me, I want you, can you tell me your favorite movie or your favorite song? I don't have one.
Right. Yeah. There's too many.
Too many.
Yeah.
Well, so that kind of leads into our last question, which is, we all have like those albums or songs that just, they speak to us in a way that we can't explain to anyone else. Like they are just our go-to.
Right.
For whatever mood we're in. And it's like, we can't explain to anyone why we love that song so much or that album. So what is that for you? That song that you come back to that's emotional?
I'm looking in my book right now because I do have a chapter where I suggest listening to things that I've always loved. And, I'm looking for it right now, but I'm not seeing it. The bottom line is, again, I have different answers to that. I would say that when I heard Born to Run, we had bought the record, it had just come out, and we played it in the studio. And that production, that song, everything about that record blew my mind. That whole album, but Born to Run, cranked up in the studio, was one of those memories I'll never forget. And that song always inspires me. There's so many though. Walking in Memphis, Mark Cohn's.
Oh, I love that song.
I think is one of the greatest songs ever, and one of the greatest records as well. His voice, the production, the arrangement, the song,
that's it.
And of course, obviously, certain Beatles songs and stuff. But I don't have one, you know.
Man, so that walk into Memphis just brought back that.
That's one of
It's
them.
like a core memory for me. Because what is it? Tell me if you're a Christian in the Ma'am I Am Tonight. Is that what the line is? Holy, did I get a line almost right for
You
a song
did.
that I
You
holy,
did. You
holy.
did.
But see, that's how I know that it is like a core song for me is,
That's how you
like
know it's
walking with
home verse
my
16.
my feet 10 feet off the Beale. That like that is, that song. Sorry,
I'm
that
looking.
is
I'm looking in the book now to find this. Oh yeah, here it is. There is a chapter in the book that has about 50 different things that I love, and Born to Run is number one, but not in that order particularly. But it's listed first. Walking in Memphis is there. Wuthering Heights by Kate Bush is absolutely a brilliant everything. MacArthur Park that Jimmy did when he was 21 with Richard Harris. Was absolutely again trailblazing. Buddy Holly songs. I have so many things I love. And it's very hard to say I have one, you know.
And it sounds like the Born to Run came out right when you really were starting.
I think it came out probably around 1975, maybe, or something, or six.
Yes,
3 years.
So I
'75.
was
That's
already
right.
3 years into producing. And that's why we were in the studio, and we got the LP, and we put it on in the studio and put the speakers on blast, and it was just
I just love that. Mesmerizing.
It was like, holy moly, that's, you know.
And I guess that's a perfect song for you because I mean you were meant to do this. You were born to run, you know, with this. So it's perfect, you know? Hell yeah,
I understood it, but it was really the power of the music. It just,
Well, he's a amazing artist, just period.
I've only got to meet Bruce once. I produced his wife doing a duet, and went to his house and hung out with him, and it was lovely. I mean, he was a lovely guy.
He's
Nice, nice.
it's pretty. You've worked with some of the greats, a lot of the greats.
Thank you.
Might even argue that you are one of the
You are
greats.
great.
So,
You're like, oh, whatever, dude. You're too humble,
I'm
man.
honestly. I don't take compliments that great,
I
you know.
know, yeah, you're
I'm
too
sorry.
humble.
I can have that thought, whether you agree with it or not. I am
I'm very.
amazed.
I'm listen. I love hearing it. If it comes sincerely, it means a lot to me. Of course, it
I
does.
am, you know, when James sent me a text last night and asked if I was free, I was like, I am, except I have somewhere to go. And I was like, who is it? Because I was kind of like, you know, it depends on, because I'm going to have to do research. It's already, you know, in the evening. And he sent me your name. And I was like, I don't know who that is. And I looked you up and I was like, holy crap, I do know who that is.
And I'm like, I know you.
So I'm so excited that I was able to be here and get to talk to you and learn more about your history. And
I'm equally thrilled. Thank you.
it's so
Thank you.
Fred, thank you so much for being here with us today. I'm so grateful you spent some of your time with us, and hopefully there's more work from you to come. At the very least, your book that's coming
Yes,
out
I'm gonna order
here
it
in
today.
the
Oh no, I mean, listen,
next.
I'm gonna keep producing until they cart me away.
There you go. Yes, and
Perfect.
then yeah, awesome.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. And please come back anytime you want to. We were glad to have you back. Anytime you want to talk about anything at all, just
Well,
send me
you
an email
know,
and we'll get it going, you know.
I'm again.
Your
You
cheap
got
date.
me. You got me anytime you want me. It's all good.
Amanda
Thank you
says your
so
cheap
much.
date.
Very
I am.
reciprocal here. Thank
There
you.
you go. All right.
Thank you so
So
much.
thank you everybody for listening. And always remember, when words fail.
Music speaks.
Hi, guys.
Bye.